everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's November 2024, and you're listening to episode 420, which is a spoiler-filled conversation about the film Heretic, starring Hugh Grant, and in theaters now. Today's guest is Cole Burgett. He is a graduate of Dallas Theological Seminary and the Moody Bible Institute. He teaches systematic theology and Bible exposition classes and writes extensively about theology and popular culture. Cole has written an online film review article for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called Heretic, The Gospel According to Mr. Reed, and you can read it for free at equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. Cole, it's good to have you on the podcast again.
Always fun to be here. Thanks.
Well, today, as I mentioned, we are talking about a film that is in theaters now, and it is starring, as I mentioned, Hugh Grant, kind of going against his typical type that he has done in most of his career. And he's, I guess, branched out into a little bit darker roles these days. So tell us a little bit about this horror film, Heretic. And I think before we even start talking about it, one of the questions I want to ask you about, because there's a lot to talk about the content, is we've talked about horror films. We're going to link that, why Christians should consider seeing them. But is this a film you could have Christians see?
So Heretic is, it starts with these two young Mormon missionaries, sisters Barnes and Paxton, who cross paths with this character named Mr. Reed, played by Hugh Grant. And Reed, I would say, is sort of destined to go down as one of the more memorable modern horror film villains. He's very charismatic, sort of mysterious, very intelligent, but ultimately really unsettling. He's sort of, you know, checking all the boxes for a classic villain. And he claims through dialogue with these characters, with the Mormons, and this is a very talky movie, surprisingly talky for a horror film. He claims through the dialogue with these sisters that he has discovered what he calls the one true religion. And as they get drawn deeper into sort of his world, we'll call it that, they really find their beliefs being challenged, and not just challenged, but manipulated. In a lot of fairly interesting ways. And the whole film follows sort of their journey. This is a very small film. It's a very contained film. It was made on a budget of less than $10 million. It's very much a one-location movie with really only three major characters at play. The whole film sort of follows these sisters as they begin to sort of confront the ideas that Reed is putting forward, and sort of ultimately reveals that the whole thing he's driving at is less about, you know, quote unquote truth, and more about control, domination, the power of suggestion, manipulating one's willingness to believe in the supernatural to sort of move them like pieces on a chessboard to get them where he wants them. It's really sort of interesting. As far as why would Christians even care about a film featuring two Mormon missionaries? It's because the movie is less about Mormonism or the LDS church, and it's more about religion in general. And its themes are really universal in some ways. Issues of belief, manipulation, discernment, issues that should matter to Christians as well. Reed's tactics and arguments raise concerns that really would resonate, I think, with any person of faith, not just Christianity. In fact, the big three, if you will, the big three monotheistic religions are talked about kind of at length in the film. So even though the two Mormon missionaries are the window into the discussion for this particular film, the ideas at play touch on all the major faiths in the world today. And it's really that the film serves as kind of a really effective parable about how easily religion can be abused when it's used as a means of control, and how easily even a well-meaning person of faith can be manipulated when their faith is sort of blind and lacking any kind of discernment or critical thinking. So even though it's marketed as a horror film, I would argue it's not quite a horror film. It's more of a thriller, a very intense thriller that uses horror tropes. One of my friends who is a horror filmmaker, he went and saw the film and we talked about it at length afterwards. And he said very quickly, he said, this is not a horror film. The marketing for this film is going to market it as a horror film because that's how they'll get people in the seats. But this is not a horror film in any traditional sense. It is a very brainy, if you will, and intelligent thriller, I think is the best way to frame it. But very, very interesting, very interesting film.
Well, it is rated R, and there are some maybe horror tropes in there. Do you think Christians could see it, or do you think for a warning, well, it, you know, you're going to encounter gore or, you know,
if you
violence, extreme violence, maybe?
If you have a weak stomach, there is one scene in particular that you'll probably have to look away from. Do I think that is worth not seeing the film? Personally, no, because it is a film that is asking to be talked about. It is asking to be interacted with by people of faith. And these kinds of films don't come along very often. These kinds of films that aren't horrendously cynical about matters of faith, that aren't sort of, let's say, stuck up or pretentious and preachy when it comes to critiquing religion. This film does that, but not in a way that is pretentious. And I think that's very important. Every person that I have talked to who has seen the film, from a lapsed Catholic to a committed Christian to a very sort of nominal, I would, you know, based on the conversations we have had, someone who doesn't really claim to be of any sort of faith, all of them have been very eager to interact with the ideas presented in the film, particularly on the subject of religion. And I think that's very important. So I would say it this way. I was having this conversation with one of my coworkers. He and his wife are Christians. They're very active in their church. He's a Bible teacher, teaches apologetics specifically. And I was talking to him about this film. He said his wife does not do horror films at all, but he really wants to see this movie. Could she sit through it? And I kind of said the same thing. If she has a weak stomach, there's one particular scene I can sort of see becoming an issue. And while the film leverages at, to use your word, horror tropes, it certainly plays that tension against the audience. This was the topic of conversation I had with the horror filmmaker friend of mine. The film very wisely understands that we have been conditioned as audiences to look for things like jump scares, right? So you know a jump scare is coming, you sort of tense up waiting for it. This is a film where it never comes. And yet, the filmmakers intentionally tease you in that way so that it keeps you on the edge of your seat. But one of the things that we said is if the first time you watch it, it's very tense. You're not sure what's around the next corner. But then having seen it, watching it the second time through, it's a very different kind of movie because you understand that a lot of the the jump scares aren't even there. They're never going to be paid off. It's more of a film about ideas, and the real tension of the movie is the conflict between ideas and different arguments being made on the subject of religion. It's just a very unique kind of horror film. And I would say it this way. If a Christian is going to consider watching a horror film, this is one of the movies that I would say 100% consider watching. 100% consider watching. Because its horror tropes are there, but it's not the traditional horror film. And I think there's a certain strength to that. So be aware that it is rated R. It's not rated R for nudity or sexual content or anything like that. None of that's not really in the film at all. There is one particular scene. It's not particularly lingered upon that I can see where the rated R, the R rating comes in, simply because it is fairly bloody and fairly violent. But beyond that one scene, which I can completely see that scene alone getting the film the R rating, beyond that scene, you're not really going to encounter terrible language. You're not really going to encounter sexual content. Again, it's a very different kind of horror film and very clean by a lot of horror standards. So 100% I can say that, you know, if you have a weak stomach and you don't really like a lot of tension in movies, then stay away from this film. That being said, if you're interested in the conversation about religion, the ease with which religion is manipulated, if you're interested in apologetics, Christian apologetics, and you can stomach one particular scene where there's some blood involved, then this is absolutely a film to really consider watching.
You've heard me talk about ways in which you can keep the content coming from the Christian Research Journal and become a partner with us, because we no longer have paid subscriptions. And one of the ways you might not know you can do this is to receive a resource for your partnering donation specifically from one of the authors that we have featured on our podcast. And to do this, go to equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. And then you'll see right underneath Christian Research Institute, you will see to the left there, Journal. If you click on that, you'll come to the landing page for all things Christian Research Journal, whether it's our free brand new weekly article, whether it's the landing page for the Postmodern Realities podcast, where you can go to any of those landing pages and give us a tip, or if it's to listen to our brand new podcast that you don't want to miss out from subscribing to, which is Christian Research Journal Reads, which is basically just audio versions of journal articles that are very popular. If you scroll down on that journal page, you will see resources from contributing writers to the journal. Some of them that we have featured currently is this summer I interviewed Ben Shaw about the reliability of the New Testament. You can get his new book, Trustworthy. A regular guest on this podcast is our consulting editor, Lindsay Medenwalt, and she has published a very practical book that she's written for you called Bridge Building Apologetics, How to Get Along Even When We Disagree. Another resource that we have featured was one of the episodes from last year. It's about Mormonism, and it's called Responding to the Mormon Missionary Message. How do you respond to those Mormon missionaries that knock on your door? And of course, one of our most prolific authors to our journal for more than 30 years is Dr. Doug Groteis, and one of his more recent books is called World Religion in 7 Sentences, a small introduction to a vast topic. So if you give us a partnering gift for any one of those books, as our thank you, we will send you a copy of one of these books from our writers. So I hope that you will help us to continue to bring you all of this free content that you're getting by giving us a partnering gift for one of these resources. Now, I know you could just go onto Amazon or go to your favorite online bookseller, but we're asking you to consider giving us a partnering gift and, as a thank you, receiving one of these books. Well, thanks for your consideration. And now back to more about the film Heretic with journal writer Cole Brigette. Well, a few moments ago at the beginning of the podcast, you said in the film that actor Hugh Grant, who's playing this, you said, you know, probably going to be a classic horror film villain named Mr. Reed. He says that he has discovered the one true religion. And so he starts this discussion by saying that all religions are just basically distorting one another. And of course, the way they get into all of this is these two girls are Mormon missionaries. And I will say in reviews I've read about the film, this intensive discussion about religion was really praised from non-religious reviewers. They're saying that is the heart of this film. It's almost like play-like, this discussion with these three characters, and they thought it was really quite the best part of the film. And he says that, you know, Mormons are, quote, a new kind of Christianity. So how can Christians engage, particularly Christian apologists? I think, like, the whole setup of this film, the content of this film, albeit besides the one, you know, really bloody scene you mentioned, really is something that Christian apologists can for sure get into talking with people who've seen the film about. So how can Christians engage with this part of the discussion that they have in the film?
Yeah, just to echo that, I mentioned the Bible teacher, coworker I have. He is an apologetics teacher. And when I cleared the theater, I text this guy because he teaches apologetics. And I said, purely on the basis of apologetics alone, you have to see this film, because it is the perfect sort of cultural artifact. If you're talking about doing cultural apologetics, this is the kind of thing that you really look for. And I'll approach Reed's idea in this way. What Reed basically articulates is a view that is frequently taken in the study of what is sometimes referred to as comparative religion. Comparative religion is an academic field that studies the similarities and differences among different world religions, often with an emphasis on how they function within societies. Now, at a college level, introductory courses in comparative religion often present religion as a cultural or social construct that evolved in order to address universal human questions about things like existence, morality, the supernatural. This perspective sometimes includes the view that religions have historically been used as tools to control populations by societal leaders shaping behavior through shared beliefs, rituals, that sort of thing. And let me just say that before I went to the Moody Bible Institute and did my stuff in Bible, I spent a year at a state school that I won't name. I hated it. But you could hear echoes of this in the classrooms there. And there were kids that I went to school with who were started out very committed Christians. And by the time they came through these classes, had very much sort of dropped the faith altogether. It was actually quite remarkable in some respects to watch. And it actually reinforced to me the dangers of shallow theology and very shallow church experience, because I was watching... I would not say that I had a very profound church experience growing up. I wouldn't say I've ever had a profound, too many profound church experiences, period. But I was not someone who had these great academic pastors, these very detailed theologians when I was growing up.
Isn't it a cliche, though, that you're saying, you know, the Christian kid who's not been equipped, they go off to, you know, State University USA in Religion 101, has never heard these things.
Yes.
This crisis of faith, and then they just deconvert.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. That was actually a conversation I had with a friend of mine during that time, is that do you not realize how cliched you're being? You are being the stereotype. And I would see that stuff. And like I said, I never really had detailed stuff growing up. So it's not like I was looking down my nose at some of these people. in many ways, I would say my experience compared to theirs was probably subpar because of where I grew up. Where, you know, I came from the mountains of Kentucky and West Virginia, you know, especially out of more fundamentalist movements. They're not known for strong academia. They're not known for critical thinking skills. But I would watch these young kids who had never really been challenged in their thinking, not just even religion, but just in their thinking. And they would fall away. And to just sort of flesh this out a little bit, right? Because I don't want to give the impression that the film is simply a soapbox for this position, because it is not. There is a real danger in which this film could have become that. And I do think that most films of this ilk do become that. They become a sounding board for what is basically a religion, like you said, 101 comparative religions course. This film does not do that, because the second that Reed is done with his presentation, one of the sisters turns out to be really well versed in some of this stuff, and she sort of bats back and engages in a really an apologetics kind of discussion with him that's really fascinating to see. But just to flesh this out a little bit for those who maybe still aren't completely clear on the common arguments in comparative religion, there are, I would say, about four kinds of arguments here. One is that religions have evolved primarily as tools of control. This perspective is often explored, and it's all sort of undergirded by the idea that religions develop to unify societies, to reinforce social hierarchies, and obviously maintain control over people. It suggests that religious doctrines and practices were often aligned with the interests of those in power, and were designed to promote conformity and obedience rather than anything like objective truth. This argument is sort of grounded in the idea of religious similarities. It suggests that because many religions share similar motifs, moral laws, afterlife beliefs, savior figures, etc., they're essentially interchangeable. This is a major crux of Reed's argument in the film. This often leads to the idea that religions are in and of themselves not interested in absolute truths, but again, societal tools that have been crafted to answer shared human questions and ultimately control behavior. Within this concept, it is maintained, held, that religions evolved by borrowing from one another, especially in times of cultural contact. You'll often hear this in movies or in college courses. Someone will say something to the effect of, you can find a bunch of quote-unquote dying and rising God figures in the centuries before Christ. The suggestion here is that no religion is really quote-unquote pure, but instead adapts to fit societal needs, which furthers the argument that religions are human inventions meant to control social or political dynamics. Often, comparative religion emphasizes that each faith tradition therefore reflects its unique cultural context and not a set of beliefs. It reinforces the idea that they don't offer objective truth, but function instead as, let's say, culturally specific tools for managing behavior and reinforcing different norms. And so with these introductory courses, and this is where the thinking Christian can sort of see through this quite quickly. These arguments are frequently presented in like a Religion 101 course without deep engagement with specific religious truth claims, especially Christianity's historical claims. And so what it leads to is this very surface level view of religion as a concept, as this elaborate form of social control, rather than as an earnest quest for truth, if that sort of makes sense. And there are a few things that I would say the Christian can do to engage with Reed's view. And some of this is going to dip a little into philosophy. Some of it's going to dip into logic and rhetoric and that kind of thing. And the first major thing to point out, and this is sort of the low-hanging fruit, is what is known as, in philosophy, the genetic fallacy. First off, Reed's dismissal of Christianity, which he does this actually using Monopoly, the board game Monopoly, as an illustration. It's very sort of brilliant.
Yes, I saw that in reviews that he used that. It was like a top shot that it shows the board or something.
Yep. His dismissal of Christianity and other religions based on similarities alone. And again, he compares this to the way that Monopoly has evolved over time, basically to say that the original game designer has been lost due to all of these different and newer and sleeker and updated versions of it. Based on similarities alone, right? His argument is that, is based on similarities alone. This is what is known as the genetic fallacy. He assumes that since all religions share certain themes, they must all just be cultural inventions designed for control. But again, this logic sort of ignores Christianity's foundational claims, like the resurrection of Jesus, which is rooted in a specific historical event. We talked about this before a little bit. We touched on it in the, I think it was the C.S. Lewis podcast, where this is the kind of thing that Lewis really took hold of, because he was exploring this stuff from the realm of mythology, or what we might consider comparative mythology. And it was the specific truth claims and the connectedness to historical events that really started to win Lewis over in his thinking and moved him from atheist to the Christian that we all sort of know and remember today. Christianity's claims are not just abstract ideas. They're tied to real events and teachings that stand apart from the idea of religion as merely a means of control. The second thing to say about this, which we sort of touched on already, is the oversimplification of similarities. Reed oversimplifies the similarities between religions. And by the way, this is something that in the film itself, Sister Barnes, I think it is, actually points out to him. I think she looks at him at one point, and it's kind of funny, the point that she's making. But she sort of looks at one of these pictures he's got. I think it's of Horus, the Egyptian deity Horus. And I think she says something like, look, if you're just trying to conflate all of these things, you're ignoring the differences. I mean, one of these characters has like a bird head. And her point is that's very different from a religion that is really, really grounded in the nitty gritty of humanity. So he sort of oversimplifies these similarities between religions and brushes aside not just doctrinal differences, but also that key historical element that really sets something like Christianity apart. For instance, Christianity uniquely teaches salvation by grace through faith, as opposed to works or rituals, which completely undermines the notion of it being just another model built to keep people in line. I mean, this is why in the early church, the earliest stages of the church, the Gentiles gravitated toward this stuff because it was so different. It was so new. And then, of course, to circle back around, the historical foundations. Christianity is anchored in historical claims. The life, death, the resurrection of Jesus are documented, well documented by eyewitness accounts, which we have in the form of what we call the Gospels, and set within a specific historical context, unlike many religious narratives that are primarily mythological. So the Christian could respond to and interact with these ideas by pointing out that Christianity rests on verifiable claims and actual history, which makes it more than just a tool of social control. This is one of the exercises I do with my high school students, especially when we're going through the book of Acts, when Peter and the rest of the apostles are selecting an apostle to replace Judas. It gives a very specific criteria for who could be an apostle. And I know that that's a term that some denominations just throw out there today, but if you're actually trying to be a biblicist about it and you're actually paying attention to the context, Timothy wasn't an apostle for good reason. Paul was.
and the others were, while some others weren't. Well, what's the difference there? Well, the criteria for apostleship had to be an eyewitness. It had to be somebody who knew Jesus, who had walked with him from the beginning of his ministry, who had been an eyewitness to the death and resurrection. And that eyewitness, again, that verifiable eyewitness testimony was very, very important for the people in the early church. And so don't underestimate the power of the historical foundations or the historical context that the gospel writers really gravitated towards. So those are just some ways I could say people could interact with what Reed is putting forward in the film.
That is really interesting. Now, one of the characters, who is Sister Barnes, actually rebuts some of his argument by, mm-hmm. you know, emphasizing key differences between religions that Reed kind of tries to conflate as one, which is, you know, when you're doing Christian apologetics, that's one of the things that people will say, well, they're really all the same, or they're all iterations of the same. So is her rebuttal a worthwhile argument against what he's trying to put forth here?
Yes, I think so. It's not a well-rounded argument, but again, remember that this is a narrative. So it is not so much an apologetics film, but it is a film that is interested in these ideas and invites people into the discussion. So Sister Barnes marshals an argument against that is coherent. It's obviously not going to go far enough because there still has to be tension and character development and that sort of thing all throughout the movie. But the position that she articulates, primarily from what I can recall, again, this is a very talky film and the dialogue is sort of snappy and it goes very quick. But when I was watching it, I remember very distinctly her latching on to the core differences between religions. Again, she's pointing out that, well, you know, this one has a bird head and this one, you know, there are differences there. This approach is valuable because it sort of highlights the shallowness with which simply looking at the motifs and drawing a, well, it's all it's all the same kind of conclusion. It just doesn't really make good sense in light of the rest of the argument. It's hard to argue that religions serve a unifying and controlling function when there are these drastic differences, these radically different concepts within them. Religions don't just serve a unifying or controlling function, but also make unique truth claims about reality, purpose, morality. For instance, Christianity claims that salvation comes through faith in Jesus, a concept that is radically different from religions with ritualistic salvation or even something like karma. Those are very, very distinct concepts. And pointing out these differences counters the idea that all religions are just these sort of interchangeable control mechanisms. But beyond pointing out differences, I think, you know, it's sort of the Christian who can uniquely go further by explaining that Jesus offers liberation from control, specifically freedom from sin, freedom from death, through what we would call, quote unquote, a relationship with Christ, rather than enforced obedience to a religious system. And I really do mean this. As a biblicist, I sort of did my THM in not just systematic theology, but in Bible exposition. If you really pay attention to the discussions going on in the early church, so starting in the book of Acts and going through Romans, Galatians, Ephesians, the letters to the Corinthians, the letters to the Thessalonians, if you look at the common theme, the common problem that Paul is addressing in those letters, the central question of the New Testament is, what is the New Testament believer's relationship to the Old Testament law? I mean, this sort of topic is something that was even rearing its head by the year 50 AD in the churches. Because you had the Gentiles who didn't know what the law was. They may have known who the Jewish people were. They may have, you know, known what was being taught in the synagogues, but they weren't. They didn't have the cultural background that a Pharisee would, that a Jewish person would. So the Gentiles are coming into this system that started in Jerusalem, that started with the Jews. Again, this is that idea that the gospel is revealed from faith to faith, first to the Jew, then to the Gentile, Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, then to the ends of the earth. It starts in Jerusalem with the Jews. It goes out to the Gentiles. The Gentiles are coming in, and the Pharisees who converted, this is Acts chapter 15, the Pharisees who converted to follow Christ were still bringing their, you know, Pharisaical mindset with them regarding the law, and believed that the Gentiles needed to sort of be controlled by this. They believed that the Gentiles needed to begin adopting the law. So this discussion of the difference between enforced obedience and then freedom from sin, or what Paul calls freedom from the law of sin and death that leads to sin and death, is actually a major, major question in the early church and in the New Testament. Really, it for my money, it is the central topic of discussion in the early church in the New Testament. So the ideas at play here, especially this idea of control, the Christian really can latch onto. And Sister Barnes' rebuttal along these lines very, very much inches us in that direction.
That is really interesting that all this is going on in this setting of the kind of horror film and spookiness. So because of that, of course, you know, I read reviews that were like, why did you go in his house? Didn't you see his walls are metal? So eventually he takes the girls down to the basement, which is probably pretty foreboding. And he's going to show them, supposedly, a prophet of the one true religion. So what is the prophet figure that is revealed in the film?
Yeah, so this is where I would say the film sort of does its most horror stuff, because the prophet is sort of dressed up to be this horror type figure. But what's interesting in the narrative is that the prophet Reed claims that the prophet actually has the power to be resurrected, and this is sort of what he promises them. If you pass through one of these doors, right, you end up in the basement. And in the basement, they're going to encounter this prophet figure, and he is going to show them the one true religion. This prophet is a prophet of the one true religion. And the idea is that the prophet will sort of kill themselves and then be resurrected. And when they come back, they bring a kind of prophecy from what Reed calls the other side. And so obviously there's going to be spoilers for this. So if you do intend to see the film, I would say at this point you want to stop listening, because it's going to be hard to talk about the rest of this if we just don't get into what the twist of this whole thing is. So the prophet does sort of kill themselves. And in a window of time, after a window of time, appears to come back to life and deliver some kind of prophecy. But in doing that, one of the girls thinks that it's not that it's completely fabricated. It's that the prophet sort of tells her something that suggests not all is as it seems. And this starts the slow unwinding and the figuring out of Reed's true game here. Because remember, in what Reed is propagating, which this all comes out at the end, what Reed is propagating is that all of these different religious beliefs are designed to control. The one true religion, by the end of the film, is what he calls control. In other words, there's no truth to any of this. There's no objective truth to any of these religions. They're all just systems of control. And the point that he's making is, just as I was able to manipulate you girls through your willingness to believe in the supernatural, through your willingness to believe in things like a resurrection and these types of things, I've sort of proven to you this idea of control. So what it turns out the prophet is doing, because this is sort of the climax of the movie, when Sister Paxton, I think it is, when she sort of gets to the underground chamber, she finds all of these emaciated people, women, who are locked in cages, and they're all sort of wearing the same garbs as the prophet. And there are these little clues planted throughout the movie that, again, it's not all is as it seems. It's all sort of one big manipulation on Reed's part. And these women in these cages are all people who have bought into Reed's idea. They have bought into this belief that he actually can show them the one true religion. And he's sort of got them all believing that if they just kill themselves as the prophet, that they will be able to go to the other side, whatever the other side is, and come back with these prophecies, when really what is happening is when they kill themselves, they're dying. And he is removing the bodies, and another prophet goes in and takes their place. And so when the girl, Paxton, sees the prophet do this, she notices that there's something different about the prophet who appears to, quote unquote, come back and deliver this prophecy to her, who also tries to seem to lace in there this hint that this is all a farce anyway. And again, this is where, once she finds the women in the cages, she realizes that all of these people have willingly put themselves in this position because they believe that Reed is going to show them the quote unquote one true religion. And this is where Reed sort of presents to her this idea, because she figures it out. He presents to her this idea that these women are proof of exactly what I'm telling you, that because of their willingness to believe in anything, I am able to manipulate them into literally locking themselves in a cage and waiting for me to tell them to go kill themselves, because they somehow believe that they're going to come back because I've been able to manipulate their beliefs into thinking that. And, you know, it all sort of devolves into basically saying, oh, he's nuts. Right. He's crazy. he is lost it. But the point that he's making, it has a lot to do with just blind faith and an uncritical reflection on beliefs. And that's where the film sort of gets its real narrative thrust, its real thematic thrust. So the prophet is this figure, to round this that part of the discussion out. The prophet is just this figure that Reed claims has the ability to resurrect, when really there are a whole bunch of prophets, which are really just these emaciated human beings who have, you know, been starved and brought to the brink of death because they think that in that sort of state right on the verge of death, that if they kill themselves, they're going to come back with this great prophecy, because Reed has manipulated them into thinking so. And he then uses them to manipulate other people into thinking the same thing. But Paxton manages to see through it and figure all of this out.
Right. And you said that, you know, she sees that it's a scheme, and, you know, he's got this ability to manipulate these, I guess, women to believe false narratives. So what does the film really saying here about religion and blind faith, that it's kind of, I don't want to say an allegory, but, you know, you are the equivalent of these emaciated, starved, trapped women if you are just blindly believing in something that's being fed to you,
yep,
in the name of religion.
Yeah, that is 100% Reed's point. If you're this, you are as good as these women right here. This is what somebody else is doing to you. You're just, you know, more than happy to let it happen. So the film definitely sends a very strong warning about blind or unexamined faith. Again, Reed's manipulation, the whole thing, the whole scheme rests on, depends on the sister's willingness to believe without really questioning. And that's actually in the early part of the film, when they're having these conversations about the similarities between religions and all this kind of stuff, before you get down to the real dark stuff. When they're having these general conversations to begin with, and this is the scene that's very iconic in the trailers that we've all seen, where he says there are two doors, and on one door he writes belief, and on the other door he writes disbelief. And after he propagates these ideas to them, he says, okay, now based on this information, you have to choose which door to go through based on what it is that you believe. Well, he does all of these little subtle manipulation tactics to get them to start to question their faith. a good example of this, because I've seen a lot of reviewers mention it, this whole blueberry pie thing. It sounds very sinister. It's actually really not. And it's the first big clue that something is very wrong in the movie. When the sisters first come to his door and he asks them to come in, they ask him, is your wife home? Because there has to be a woman present. We can't come into the house with just a guy. And he says, yeah, my wife's in the house, and she's making blueberry pie. And so when they come inside, they're commenting on the smell of the pie. Oh, it smells so good. And so they sit down, they start having conversations. And the whole time he's like doing little things, right? Like any something anybody would do. He lights a candle, he takes their coats, all that kind of stuff. But then when he's out of the room, one of the girls happens to look over and she sees the candle that is burning is the scent of blueberry pie. So the pie that they think they're smelling, you see what I'm saying? It's not there. It's the candle. So there are all of these little things like that where he's subtly beginning to manipulate them. And then he asks them to question that stuff, right? Why is it that you just believed me when I told you these things? Why is it that you just thought these things based on what you've heard? When it's all reinforcing that idea that everything is it's the power of suggestion. It's the power of manipulation. I told you blueberry pie. You smelled the blueberry pie. You think she's there because that's there, when really it's just this candle burning and something I told you. It's all one big misdirection. So his ability to manipulate hinges upon the sister's willingness to believe him and what he's showing them without really questioning, showing how easily faith can be misused when it's disconnected from truth and discernment. And this theme actually lines up with certain passages of biblical advice. 1 John 4:1, test the spirits. 1 Peter 3:15, have a reasoned faith. From a Christian perspective, faith is not easy believism. It's not believing without reasoning. One of my coworkers who does the systematic theology courses is in this unit right now with the juniors we have in high school. It's believing with understanding. It's believing with reason. And Heretic, the film, highlights how dangerous it is to follow beliefs without question, especially when those beliefs are being used as a means of control, which, let's be fair, has happened at different points throughout history. For sure that's happened. Especially when beliefs are being used as a means of control rather than truth. Christianity itself teaches that faith should be rooted in the truth of God's word and evidence, like the eyewitness accounts of the resurrection, not just in the authority of a charismatic figure or a manipulative idea. In fact, those people tend to be the ones that scripture warns against the most.
So it's really interesting. You said he comes off as, you know, unhinged, maybe insane. So he keeps talking about in the film, one true religion. And at its core, what is the one true religion that he's speaking of? Is he just using that as a way to get them to, you know, maybe buy into what he's offering them before he takes them to the basement? Or is it's just, he's just crazy talk, you know, he's just a weirdo?
Yeah, it's all a ploy. Well, he is crazy and he is a weirdo, but he's a very intelligent one and fairly well-read. The one true religion language is nothing more than his own creation. It's a blend of beliefs designed to reinforce his authority. In his own words, that one true religion is control. In other words, there isn't really truth to any of the religions. The truth is that it's all about people controlling you. It's all about whoever is going to be smart enough to manipulate the masses into thinking whatever it is he wants them to think. It's his personal invention, right? Control. This one true religion is what he calls his personal invention, meant to give him an air of exclusivity and power over the sisters. His ideology isn't about spiritual insight. It's really a cult of personality, a self-serving construct aimed at control and dominance. So for Christians, Reed's character is, again, it's this reminder of the dangers of following charismatic figures who claim exclusive access to quote-unquote truth, but fail to root their teachings in anything verifiable or even just authentic. In Christianity, the idea of exclusivity isn't based on one person's opinion or charisma. It is grounded in the historical life, death, and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. Christianity's core beliefs are anchored in real events and teachings, and very public teachings, which can be explored, examined, and trusted. You know, one of the major points that I'll make with students, be it the high school students or the college students I teach, is that Christianity has historically been a very public religion. We are very skeptical of people and should be very skeptical of people.
We don't have secret insights.
Exactly.
Cultic groups, that's the thing. Join us and we'll give you the secret insight to something.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Historically, we have always, from the very beginning, been very skeptical of people like that. You know, Paul, I mean, just look at the examples in Scripture. Paul really has good things to say about the Bereans because they are not like that, because they don't trust him initially. Because when he shows up and begins teaching about Jesus, they bust open their Old Testament scriptures and are checking what he's teaching against it. Jesus himself didn't speak into a vacuum. He rooted his teachings in the established Old Testament scriptures. Again, it's very public. We are very skeptical of cults of personality, or at least we should be. The church should be skeptical of those kinds of things. So the film itself, again, is a very powerful, it's almost like a parable, right? It's a powerful illustration, parable of the dangers of following manipulative leaders who use faith as a tool for control. And for Christians especially, it serves as a great reminder of the importance of having a reasoned, discerning faith that is rooted in truth and not manipulation. It encourages believers to know why they believe what they believe, to carefully examine what they're taught, to seek faith based in the evidence of God's word rather than human authority or just charisma. So it's a very well-made, very good film that's getting great reviews. So,
and I'd say you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, you kind of described different types of people, different kind of spiritual types of people who've seen this film. And so if a Christian goes to see the film, you know, how can they engage meaningfully with someone who's watching Heretic and comes away just wondering? Maybe it is the person who left the faith in college religion 101, or somebody who's not particularly spiritual. So how should the Christian apologist really be able to use this film as a springboard? Okay, you have some questions. Here's what I can talk to you about.
Yeah, that's actually something I was thinking about when I was watching the film, especially as Reed was talking in his first little presentation of questioning the similarities and religions, comparative religion, that stuff. I immediately thought of those people that I knew who heard this kind of stuff and was like, oh, that's an original idea, and just walked out the door happily. What I would say is, before the Christian moves to engage in those kinds of conversations, the Christian themselves needs to make sure that they have thought through the implications of what it is the person is suggesting. They need to make sure that they actually can engage with that. Now, I say that with sort of a two senses, I guess. In one sense, if we're talking about a Christian who really hasn't thought through some of these implications, who really hasn't thought, there are some similarities in different religions and mythological systems, wonder why that is, and they're just being exposed to this for the first time, the answer is probably not to respond in a very detached and emotional reaction, because that's just going to reinforce what is already sort of being believed and propagated, which is that people of faith are often very unreflective and they can't see past their own emotional needs. The flip side of that coin is this: for the Christian who has started thinking through this stuff, do not look down on the person who has those kinds of questions or ideas, even though I would agree that those positions are basically a religion 101 class in college without any sort of depth or real examining of the different just concepts in the different religions and why and the religion is different. With, you know, no pun intended, the devil really is in the details in those sorts of things. So I would say, don't look down on the person who has those kinds of questions, because again, that plays right into the idea that the whole religion game is just for stuck up people who look down on others. And I have a friend who's he's a former Marine. And I mean, this is his position on religion. This movie is his position on religion, that religion is all about control. It's all about stupid people who let themselves get manipulated, who walk willingly into subjugation and control. And, you know, talking with him, it's very fun. It's very fun talking with him because you never want to accuse him of oversimplifying when really that's kind of what's happening. And you want to work through this stuff carefully. So I would encourage the Christian who is looking to interact with people on the subject of this film. Again, maybe it is someone who left the faith. Don't react purely emotionally. You have to be able to sort of articulate the differences in specific religious systems. You have to be able to articulate what makes Jesus different from karma, what makes Jesus different from a ritualistic works-based salvation. So you really sort of have to know a little bit of doctrine. You sort of have to know your Bible pretty well in order to do that. But the flip side of the coin is to also not look down on someone who is asking those kinds of genuine questions and are wanting to interact with this stuff. So I would say don't not see the film because one somehow gets the impression that this is a movie that propagates the idea of, well, religion's all about control. Because that's not quite what it is. The ending is actually left very ambiguous. You're sort of left going, well, wait, did a miracle just save her life? Was there a very powerful experience that she just had that saved her? It's left very ambiguous, and it's sort of up to the person watching it to think through what has just happened and how the ending plays out. So this isn't a movie that is propagating Reed's ideas. And again, Reed is the villain. He is the bad guy in the movie, putting some of these ideas forward. But it definitely critiques a blind, unreflective faith, and with good cause.
Wow, that's a pretty heavy topic and very creative. At least we have to give the filmmakers props to bring up these kinds of topics in a very talky way, and yet such a creative setting. So finally, on a much lighter note, it's almost Thanksgiving. It's November. So are you turkey or pass?
Turkey.
Well, thanks, Cole, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Always good. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to episode 420 of the Postmodern Realities podcast. Today's guest was Cole Burgett. He has written an online film review article for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called Heretic, The Gospel According to Mr. Reed, and you can read it for free at equip.org.
You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Handegraff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.